So we're in the 22nd chapter of Luke, and you remember last week we talked about the Passover, that Jesus had come to the Passover, and he's in Jerusalem, and he made that transition from the Passover to the Lord's Supper. And it was, I was talking to Gene about it afterwards, and he made a point about it, and I thought it was a really good point that the Passover is a house saved by blood. And the Lord's Supper is in remembrance of what Jesus did, a house, which is, Paul tells us, is the church, a house saved by blood. So in the Passover, it was a lamb. And of course, in the Lord's Supper, it is the lamb. So it really is a nice way to look at both of those as a house saved by blood. And then in this chapter, we also looked at when Jesus said to Peter, when you have returned to me, and so he just told him, Satan is going to sift you like wheat. And when you return to me, and then Peter said, I'm ready to die for you. And then that's where Jesus said, well, you're going to deny me three times. And so today we'll get to that point where Peter does that. We're in verse 39 now. And coming out, he, Jesus, went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed, and his disciples also followed him. So the Mount of Olives is just across the Kidron Valley. It's a mountain that where there were olive trees, and the Garden of Gethsemane was on the side of that hill. And John tells us that he was he'd go there often in John 18. There's a botanist called Bove, and he went there and he looked at those olive trees that were in that on the Mount of Olives around the Garden of Gethsemane. And he wanted to find out, were these the same ones that were there when Jesus was there? Because they're just old and gnarly, and he did was able to say they're about 2,000 years old. So, which would, you know, they may be the ones. And the argument against that is that when Titus came to destroy Jerusalem in 70 AD, he put siege works around the city. And what they would do is cut down every tree they could find to build these siege works. So they don't know for sure, but that is one place, if you ever go to Jerusalem, that is a place to visit, is the Garden of Gethsemane. They pretty much know where it is, although if you're standing it, they say, well, it could be over there or it could be over there, but it's right around here somewhere. And you see these old olive trees, which could have been there. They could have been the ones. And to think about what took place in this garden. In verse 40, when he came to the place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation. So they are weary. It's past midnight now. This night has been going on. It's a dangerous time, and he's telling them, don't, you know, pray that you enter not into temptation. Verse 41, and he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, so maybe a couple hundred feet away, and he knelt down and prayed, saying, Father, if it is your will, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours. So here Jesus, even though he said over and over as we've gone through the book of Luke, that he knows what's going to happen to him. He knows what Isaiah said. He knows what David said in Psalm 22, that there are descriptions of what kind of a death he would go through. And it's overwhelming. And he prays for a way around this, but let God's will be done. Verse 43, then an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. So here's an angel that comes down, and when I read that, my first thought is, what a surprise to be in heaven and be an angel and said, go to earth and comfort the Son of God. And me, you know, to be a messenger from God and be sent and comfort deity when he's on the earth. But here it is, God the Father is taking care of his Son on the earth and sending a comforting angel. Verse 44, and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. Here, this agony, this anguish that he was in, there is a medical term. It's called hematidrosis, and it's where the capillaries near the skin actually break down, and then when you sweat, blood comes out. So there is a medical term for what was happening here, that when there is such intense struggle, that you can sweat and blood can actually come out. And this it seems like, as we read this, that's what was happening. He knew he was going to die, and he knew how. I mean, I don't know how much detail, but he could read in Isaiah and Psalms and other places that he knew those prophecies. He knew details about his own death. Verse 45, when he rose up from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. And then he said, why do you sleep? Rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation. So he repeats what he said up in verse 40. And really three times when we look at the gospel, he's come back to them and told them, don't sleep. Pray that you enter not into temptation. What was that agony like that he was going through? I mean, we can, knowing what he was going to go through, the Judas, what he did when he left him and betrayed him, even Peter, that he's going to betray him here. But really, it's also the weight of the sin of the world, because this is the event that is paying for the sins of the world, and that weight is on him. Verse 47, and while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude, and he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. So here's, first of all, a multitude, and when you put together the other gospels, all four accounts. Who was this multitude right now in the garden there? Officers, temple guards, Pharisees, scribes, servants, chief priests, captains of the temple, elders, and they were carrying lanterns, torches, weapons, swords, staves, which would just be any stick that would work for a weapon, clubs. So you get this picture of a pretty good-sized mob, and you get the picture of a mob. I mean, I think of the movie Shrek, when all those guys came with, you know, after Shrek and the ogre to get rid of him. That's, you know, you got torches and weapons, and they're after you. And so they're coming here, and Jesus in verse 48 said to him, to Judas, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? So that was a regular greeting that a student would, when he's coming to the rabbi, the teacher, he would kiss. That was a regular greeting that a student would have towards his teacher. But here, again, Jesus is giving another chance to Judas. He's telling him exactly what he's doing. And, you know, we can get caught up in sin and not know what we're doing, but when it's in our face like that, then how are we going to react? We're going to see another guy, Peter, and we're going to see how he reacts when that happens. But right now, Judas does not react with, you know, oh, what am I doing? What am I thinking? He continues. verse 49. When those around him saw what was going to happen, they said to him, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? And one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. So here is Peter, who strikes the ear of Malchus, the servant of the high priest. We see this in the gospel accounts. But Jesus answered and said, permit even this. And he touched his ear and healed him. So, and I'm I'm not sure, you know, who was he talking to? But when he said, permit this, what was Jesus saying there? You have a situation, you have a mob surrounding him in the night, in the middle of the night. This is 1 a.m., and it's dark. They got lanterns, and Peter cuts off his ear, and this is about ready to explode. And we know what the scriptures tell us from the Old Testament. How was Jesus going to go to his death? Like a lamb led to the slaughter, silent. And so he does something. And whether he's talking to the mob there or to his own disciple, he just said, permit this. And he heals him. It's like he stops the explosion that's about ready to happen. And there's some good arguments on both either side who he's talking to, but I think that's what he's doing. He has just kept this from exploding by healing the Malchus. Luke is the only one that talks about this healing and of course he's a doctor. That's what he does. He's been healing people all his life, and he's always been amazed at the healing power of Jesus. And we've seen all through of this book that he focuses on that, and that's a big deal to him. Verse 52, then Jesus said to the chief priests, captains of the temple, and the elders that who had come to him, which those are the three groups that make up the Sanhedrin, that group of 71 people that were a decision-making body, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. So everyone knew that Jesus, they'd seen his life. They'd seen the kind and gentle person that he was, and they had ample opportunities to approach him in the temple. But rather than that, they come at 1:30 in the morning with lanterns, and they sneak up, and he says, this is your hour. You come in the dark. You come sneaking around in the dark. Your methods are swords and clubs. And it's really another way that Jesus has just revealed their hypocrisy. Verse 54, then having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house. And Peter followed at a distance. So here they go from the Mount Olivet, and they're going to the high priest's house. About a mile away, they've gone down into the Kidron Valley, back up into Jerusalem, and they're heading into the high priest's house, which they think they've found in Jerusalem. They're pretty sure that's what a house that fits everything. The high priest was Annas and Caiaphas. Well, wait a minute, why are there two? There should be only one high priest. Well, at the time, it was one of them was to was approved by Rome, and the other one was the one that was approved by the Jewish people there in Jerusalem. So you had this kind of duality there, and they were relatives, Annas and Caiaphas. But you're going to have the first two trials by Annas and Caiaphas. So he's going to go through several trials here, but that's the first one. They brought him into the high priest's house, and Peter followed at a distance, and we know from the other Gospels that John did too. Now, when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. So Peter came into the courtyard, and we found out from the other Gospels that John knew the Sanhedrin, and he let them in to that high priest's house. He let Peter in. And when they had kindled a fire, they sat down together. Peter sat among them. And a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, this man was also with him. But he denied him, saying, woman, I do not know him. And after a little while, another saw him and said, you also are of them. But Peter said, man, I'm not. Verse 59, then after about an hour passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, surely this fellow also was with him, for he's a Galilean. They knew Jesus was from Galilee, and this guy's a Galilean. But Peter said, man, I do not know what you're saying. And in the other accounts, we see he cursed. He's trying to establish, I don't know this guy, in a big way. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. Then Peter went away and wept bitterly. So Peter's reaction to being faced with what he did, what have I done, was he was devastated. He was brokenhearted. He wept bitterly. And he was embarrassed. What have I done to the Lord? I just said I would die for him. I'd go to prison and die for him. And here it is, I won't even acknowledge him. And it's one of those things that when we look at it, I mean, he knew better. But it's hard to apologize and repent when you do something that is so that reveals something about your own character that is so embarrassing. You know, it's devastating to find out, man, I am a hypocrite, and I am totally selfish. Look what I did. And I think, I know I have, and I imagine many of us have in our lives have done things, and then it dawns on us, what have I done? What kind of a person am I? What am I going to do? Am I going to avoid it, or am I going to weep bitterly and bow my head and come back to the Lord? So it's something that we look at Peter. He was that kind of a person. let's move now to verse 63. Now the men who held Jesus mocked him and beat him. And having blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, prophesy, who is it that struck you? And many other things they blasphemously spoke against him. So the soldiers are just humiliating him. They're degrading him. They're making it painful, and they're making a game out of it for their own amusement. And it's just a terribly brutal game. He's blindfolding them, and they're hitting him. We wonder when we read in what happened in Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 3, when those first gospel sermons were preached, and Peter says, you did this. And he's talking to the Jews in Jerusalem and others also, but he's talking to the Jews, and he said, you killed him. You did these things. And were there some of these that were there that had hit him and just humiliated him like this? I've just thought about meeting somebody in heaven someday, and I'm the guy, when deity, Jesus, when he came to earth, I hit him. I can't imagine that. I hit the Lord when he was, and there was another guy. Who was it that slapped him in the face? The servant of the high priest slapped him. I'm the guy that slapped the Lord. But then you think about that, what Jesus said in Matthew 25, when he was talking to at the judgment scene, and he says, when you did it, they asked him, when did we do these things to you, Lord? When did we help you? Or when did we not help you? And Jesus answers and said, when you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. So really, that's all of us. I mean, it's stunning. It's striking to think of somebody that hit the Lord and being in heaven and saying, I'm the guy who did that. But Jesus says, when you do that to another brother or sister in Christ, when you have not resolved something between brothers and sisters, when you do something mean, you did it unto Jesus. You're the same person. So it's something to take into our own minds really serious and you say, how do I treat other people? How do I treat the brotherhood? Verse 68, as soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council. And so saying, if you are the Christ, tell us. So here, the council was that Sanhedrin. It was made up of 24 chief priests, 24 elders, and 22 scribes. So the scribes would be more like the lawyers. The elders would be among the people, more among the people, and chief priests would be associated with the temple and the Levites. And then one more person, the high priest, was part of that. And this is, now this is 5 a.m. in the morning, right around 5 a.m., and so they've been up all night going through this mocking, games of amusement for the soldiers, if you're so now they're in front of the Sanhedrin. So there's been Annas and Caiaphas, and now they're in front of the whole Sanhedrin. And if you're the Christ, tell us. But he said unto them, if I tell you, you will by no means believe. So, and verse 68, and if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. And he makes a point here. Jesus is always thinking, it seems like when you look at these, about who's listening. Are there truth seekers out there that will hear the truth and say, you know, that's right. You know, he's revealed already that the injustice of their justice. He's revealed that. But here he's, well, remember what when John the Baptist, when he said, he asked the chief priest, John the Baptist, was he from God or from men? And they wouldn't answer him because they knew they had to take a stand. And they wouldn't answer him because that wasn't their purpose. They were just concerned with getting Jesus. And the same thing is true here. He says, if I ask you something, you won't answer. And so there's people out amongst the crowd saying, you know what? That's true. They have shown themselves to, number one, if he tells them, they won't listen. And number two, if he asks them, they won't answer. Their purpose is not justice. And so he was making it obvious so that anybody there could say, you know, and see what was really going on. Verse 69, hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. And so very soon, Jesus is going to die, go in the grave, be resurrected, and ascend into heaven, and then establish the church. And how did we know the day that he established the church? When he was sitting at the right hand and he sent power by the Holy Spirit, and all those apostles spoke in tongues, and the church was established. So that kingdom is coming, and he's going to be sitting at the right hand. And it's a good for us to remember, because as I go through this, I'm just thinking, what a horrible, unjust thing that what's happening to our Lord. But very soon, he's going to be sitting at the right hand of God. And very soon, all these people will have seen the truth and responded to it, seen the truth and maybe denied it. But they're going to die soon and stand before God, and all this is going to be right, made right. Everything's going to be okay. Hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. Then they all said, are you then the Son of God? And he said to them, you rightly say that I am. So he says, you're right. What you just said is right. So it's a way of putting the burden of the answer on them. He said, that's right. You said what's right. And verse 71, and they said, what further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth. So here, let's move now to chapter 23. Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. So here they've left the Sanhedrin. and they're moving the trial now to Pilate. Now we're going to find out. We'll get there when we get there. I think it's a little farther down. But they didn't have the right to put someone to death. They had to go through Rome. This would be going to Pilate. And so he's been put on a trial, and he's been condemned, but they couldn't do anything about it. And so here, 5 a.m. in the morning, they bring him to Pilate, and the charges change. You know, then it was blasphemy. Now the charges are political, because Pilate's not going to do anything about blasphemy, but he will do something if it's political. So they make 3 charges in verse 2. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, the king." So you look at these 3 and, okay, perverting the nation. That's kind of like going to a judge and saying, you know, this guy's a troublemaker. Well, what did he do? Well, he's a troublemaker. No, we need something to go on. There's nothing there in that charge. Forbidding to pay taxes. We already saw what Jesus taught about paying taxes. Remember, he held up the coin, said, "Whose inscription is on that coin?" "Caesar's." "Well, give it to him. Those are his." So he has publicly said, "Pay your taxes." And then, so that was just a lie. And then the third one is claiming to be Christ, the king. And so verse 3, so Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" So that's the only one Pilate deals with, the only one that has any merit so far. And when we find out, when we combine what John said in John 18, we find out a little more about this conversation, that Jesus tells him, "My kingdom is not of this world. And if it were, my servants would fight, but it's not of this world. They won't fight." So he explains that this is a different kind of kingdom. And Pilate accepts that. And he asks him, "Are you king of the Jews?" So then you'd have to go to John 18. And actually in John 6, remember they tried to make him king. And he said no, and he left. He wouldn't have anything to do with it. And then verse 4, so after you can kind of insert between 3 and 4 what happened in John 18. He's no threat to Caesar. He's not that kind of a king. Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." So he's not guilty. His kingdom is not of this world. And Pilate's going to say this 3 times. So we're going to see this in verse 14, verse 16, and verse 20, or 14 through 16, and verse 22. Then verse 5, "But they were the more fierce, saying, 'He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place.'" So now he says, this guy's a troublemaker from Galilee to Judea. All over the country, he's making trouble. Again, there's nothing to this charge. I mean, he's a troublemaker. You can't charge troublemaking. I think when I read this, I think of oftentimes there'll be a mob kind of mentality doing a march somewhere, and everybody's shouting something, and then a reporter will go out and ask individuals, "Well, what's your purpose here? Why are you here marching?" And many of the people don't know. They say, "Well, this and that," and it's kind of embarrassing. You've probably heard some of those reports that happen, and you go, and that's, I think that's what's happening, and we're going to find that's true as we get farther into this kangaroo court that's going on here, and towards the end when Jesus is actually on the cross. But this is, I think, what's happening is there is a mob mentality, and he's just using the same thing. He's a troublemaker. Well, when Pilate, verse 6, hears Galilee, "Oh, I can get out of this. That's not my jurisdiction. That's Herod's jurisdiction." So Herod was a tetrarch. he was, which means he was over one quarter of that area, and his area was Galilee and Perea. Perea is on the other side of the river, the Jordan River from Jerusalem or Judea. And so he finds here's a way out. This is Herod's jurisdiction. He sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. So this is that Herod that we've read about. He's a horrible guy. He's the guy who beheaded John. Pharisees, remember, told Jesus, Herod wants to kill you. Get out of town. And then we had that description that a person historically gave of, this is not in the Bible, this is a historical description that a person wrote down about Herod, that he was just, he was false, and he was a troublemaker, and he was just a bad, bad guy. And so verse 8, now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. That's in Luke 9:7, it says, now Herod heard of all that was done by him, and then in verse 9, and he sought to see him. So back in chapter 9, we've seen Herod's been wanting to see Jesus. But why does he want to see him? For his amusement. He wants to see a miracle. That would be cool. Let's see a miracle. And then he questioned him with many words, but he answered him nothing. So Jesus doesn't answer at all. And this is when you think about, what is the purpose of a miracle? Well, Mark tells us it's to confirm the words. So what kind of a guy is this? Well, his life is murder, incest. He's cruel, he's selfish. He is not interested. All he wants is some amusement, and that's not the purpose of miracles. So, verse 10, and the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. So they had followed from Annas and Caiaphas's house, or from the Sanhedrin to Pilate's place, which would have been the Praetorium. The Praetorium was in the fortress of Antonia, which was right next to the outside of the temple wall. They're he's a troublemaker. They're trying to get him in trouble. Verse 11, then Herod with his men of war treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. So here, Herod's response, I mean, he's just got silence out of Herod, and he's jeering at him. The soldiers around him are jeering at him, and they dressed him up, made fun of him, and then they sent him back to Pilate. It's like he's kind of getting back, maybe him embarrassed him a little, I don't know. He sent him back to Pilate, and that very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other. For before that, they'd been at enmity with each other. So Pilate didn't get rid of the case, but he made a friend out of Herod. And why? Because now Herod and Pilate agree with each other. They both have a common enemy, but he's still got to deal with the problem of what to do. Pilate doesn't believe he's guilty, but he's got to satisfy this mob, or that's what he feels like. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, you have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning these things of which you accuse him. Verse 15, no, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing worthy of death has been found in him. So here, and then he says, I will therefore chastise him and release him. He's looking for a way out. He doesn't want to commit him to death, but he says, I'll chastise him. And he's just trying to find a good way out of a bad situation, But of course, we see that justice is no part of his decision. I mean, he's just trying to quell the situation. And when he said, and release him, verse 17 says, for it was necessary for him to release one of them at the feast. And this was just a custom that they had at this Passover feast, that they would release one prisoner. And there's more information in Matthew and Mark about that that Luke doesn't go into. That's where we'll wrap it up today, and we'll pick up in verse 18 next week.